Welcome to The Point. Today, two books on personal experiences. Later in the hour, Elizabeth Saito shares some of the essays from her book, Notes from a Pandemic, a Journal of the Plague Year. But first, a memoir focusing on a family's experiences living in Alaska and Nigeria in the 1960s. Sometime a Clear Light, a photographer's journey through Alaska, Nigeria, and life. Ailet Janess is a writer, photographer, and adventurer who looks back at her life to find insight into the past as she is losing her physical sight due to macular degeneration. Ailet, welcome.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
So in the preface of the book, you write, "Why am I telling this story now so many years later? Perhaps it's because I'm losing my sight that I find myself closing my eyes to recover visions of that extraordinary time in Africa and to see what happened to me. I have macular degeneration." Talk a bit about your loss of eyesight and how that, you know, the book came to be.
Well, I began to lose my eyesight probably 30, 40 years ago, very, very slowly. And it has caused me to think more about the past and to sharpen my other senses, I guess. So I began to think about writing and talking about that experience, mostly in Nigeria.
Yeah, later in the hour, we're going to talk about the collaboration it took to make the book possible. But first, let's delve into the story a little bit. You were married at 18, right out of school, right? So tell us a little bit about that and what led to that remote village in Alaska. You and Jonathan, your now ex-husband, were high school sweethearts.
We were kids. We really didn't know what we were doing very well. And he trained as an anthropologist, and we went then first to Alaska, to a tiny Eskimo village. I never lived in a village in my entire life of that size, and we had no running water. We had what we called jokingly running people, because we had a stream, which is where everybody got their water. And by then I had a two-year-old and a newborn baby, and we lived there for a year and a half. And I kept friends from that era almost until now. Most of them have died, but it was a very profound experience for me and very safe for my kids, because in that tiny community, everybody knew everybody.
Yeah. And when did you first pick up a camera?
Oh, gosh. Probably in my 20s. Mm-hmm. Looking back now, I wish I had studied photography more seriously than I did, but I had such great opportunities, first in the Arctic and then later on in Nigeria, that had to do it.
Yeah, so self-taught, right? Self-taught.
I took courses here and there, mostly self-taught.
I think when you talk to photographers, one of the things, I remember a photographer friend who said, "I don't take pictures of things, I take picture of light," right? Light is so important when you're a photographer. And you write, "We lived in that one room for a year and a half through two winters when the sun rose just enough to light the horizon with a rosy strip of light and the snow-covered tundra was deepest glowing purple all day." Sounds beautiful.
It was beautiful.
And you've kind of been rough, like you said. You had no running water, no indoor plumbing, no doctor close by, but you felt safe, and the kids were safe.
I felt so because it was a tiny community, and everybody knew everybody else, and everybody looked out for the kids. Older kids would take my little ones out in the streets and the path by the house, and everybody would know them. And that was a very meaningful time for me in that sense.
Yeah. All right. So now you're off to Africa. Jonathan has a new job in Nigeria, right? The time you spent there were some of the most terrible times in Nigerian history, right? So what did you know about Nigeria before you went?
Oh, very little, actually. It was a British colony originally. It had just gained independence. I knew it was very varied. I learned there were 250 different languages spoken in modern Nigeria, which shows you how separated people must have been one from another until recent times.
Yeah. And tell us what Jonathan was doing in Nigeria.
He was working for the UN, doing a project to help the fishermen in the Kanji Lake Basin area retool. It was when a dam was being built across the Niger River, and thousands of people were being moved out of their homes to make way for the rising waters of the lake, and the fishermen would have to use different techniques to fish in lake waters than in river waters. So he went there to do a study to see what people needed. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it was turned out to be during the Nigerian Civil War, and I don't think the government had a lot of energy to spend on a fisheries project. Yeah. But I had a lot of time on my hands, and plenty of places to explore.
Yeah. I want to read a little bit here as you're arriving. It says, I see us, Jonathan, myself, the children, in a small motorboat moving slowly along a narrow, muddy branch of the Niger River, with tall savanna grass on both sides stretching to the flat horizon. A few small scrubby trees, low bushes. I see no houses, no roads, no villages. The air is hot and dry. The sun is scorching. Jonathan is at the stern, running the engine confidently. This is familiar to him, though new to me. The children are on either side of me, in the middle, sitting quiet, quite still, to keep the boat balanced. Sweat beads our cheeks, but a breeze on the water cools us. We round a bend, and I look up to the near bank. I am startled to see a tall, dark man wearing earrings, bracelets, and leather loincloth tied about his waist. He's carrying a bow and arrows. He raises his arm and shakes his fist at us. It's okay, Jonathan calls to us over the sound of the motor. That's a greeting, not a threat. That gesture evokes the whole of my 3 years in West Africa. Puzzling, foreign, warm, disturbing, profoundly engaging, and an impression that is still with me. It's bringing back?
Yeah, very much. It is still with me even now.
Yeah. So describe life at the station.
Well, we lived in various different places in Nigeria. The first was a biological station set up for this research project. In fact, we didn't live there very long because the Civil War had broken out and we were moved to another area. I lived most of the time that I was in Nigeria in the city of Ibadan. Mm-hmm. And it was there that I began to write vignettes of people that I was getting to know there. And those people did not like to have their photographs taken, so I didn't take photographs in that part of Nigeria at all. Then when I could, I would go to the north, where people didn't mind having their photographs taken because they had no cameras. And that was an entirely different experience. That was mostly photographic, but extraordinary.
So the first place that you were living in the station, this is where the troubles begin, right? So so talk a little bit about what was happening.
Well, it's to go back to, it was, Nigeria was a mixed tribal area always. And after it became independent, the coalition didn't hold together any longer. But it was very unclear what was dangerous and what wasn't. People from the north had moved down to the south. They were in danger in the south because it was south against the north. And when we were in that station, it wasn't clear whether it was dangerous or not. It was a very strange feeling of unease to be there.
Tell us about Daniel. Now, this is when you've moved to the city, right?
Daniel, my heart. Daniel was what was called a steward in those days. And he, I want to say he hired us. I was living in an apartment in the grounds of the University of Baden, and a knock came on the door, and I answered it. And there was this rather troubled-looking, frowning man, and said, could he come in? I said, yes. And he turned out to be a steward, and he was looking for a job, and he told me what he would do. And I had never had anything in the way of servants in my life, a cleaning lady once in a blue moon. So this blew me away. And he said he would do all the grocery shopping and do the laundry and cook the meals and serve the meals. And he was to have two uniforms, and he told me what his salary should be. And, of course, I hired him instantly.
Yeah. And he really became a part of your family. I mean, he was quite a character.
He was
like
a very dear, dear person.
Yeah. I love the story about the chicken. So you get this baby chicken, right? And it gets stepped on. And Daniel comes to the rescue. Tell us how Daniel handled that situation.
We had a baby chick on the loose, I cannot remember. But my kids, Kirik and Evan, were there, and two friends of theirs were there, and somebody stepped on the chicken. And there was a great hue and cry about that. And Daniel was in the kitchen. He went into the living room. I went into the living room. And the chicken was, little chicken, was lying on the floor.
Yeah.
Looking half dead. And we were all paralyzed. We didn't know what to do. Daniel said, I will take him to doctor. Make him well. Make him fixed. And so he took off on his bicycle, put the chicken in a basket, took off, and we waited, and we waited, and we waited, and we waited. The kids were very anxious and a little teary and worried about it. Their mother of the other boys came those boys wouldn't go home. Finally, Daniel came back in and came up the back stairs of the apartment with a big basket and opened the lid of the basket, and we all hustled around, took the lid off the basket, and in it was a much larger black chicken.
But what was it? How did he explain that?
And the kids looked at him and looked at me. He said, "Take him. Take him to doctor. Give him injection. Make him big and black and strong." And of course, if we wanted to believe that,
very clever. So. He was a clever guy. And then there was another young man that comes into your life, the young man selling antiquities. Tell us a little bit about him.
Oh, he was wonderful. He was Yoruba. He had gone to school and spoke a most wonderful flowery English. And he came to sell antiquities, which he had, which were old things from his tribal area that people were not, having become Christian, they were not interested in using anymore. And so he brought these to sell. And then I began to talk to him, and he began to tell me stories about his life. And I wrote these all down quite carefully. He wrote them down. And when he went away, he was always broke, and he began to write me these wonderful letters, and I've forgotten the earlier ones. My most favorite was, my salutation was, "Most apples of my heart." But of course I was going to give him money. Anyone who's going to say that to me?
Yeah, exactly.
Your devoted servant. Yeah. He's so sweet.
Yeah. And now there was a Christmas that something odd happened to you. You couldn't remember how long to cook the turkey or how to multiply. Just what was happening there?
I'll never know what
happened. You'll never know, right?
Never know what happened. I just lost it.
Yeah.
Temporarily. I couldn't figure out how to do anything. And my husband was there. We went off to the hospital to see a psychiatrist there, who said, after he figured out that I remembered my name and what my children's names and senior, at least, he said, "Go home."
Yeah,
go home. And it went away.
Yeah, and you never had it again.
No.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Very scary.
Yeah. Was it a stressful time for you? Do you think maybe it was some kind of a reaction to stress?
I think probably so.
Yeah.
It was during the Civil War, and my marriage was falling apart.
Yeah. And talk about that realization that your husband had another life.
Well, I think this is not uncommon. We were separated a lot of the time, and he began to have other relationships, and I, being a faithful wife, didn't do that kind of thing at all. And I think that what's behind it was that we really were very isolated from each other as people. We just were not able to make the close connection that a good marriage has. We never did.
Yeah. 1968, the third year in Nigeria, you move again. Tell us about that. That was the most deadly of the Civil War, right?
Was that when we moved?
When did you move back to America?
The end of 69.
69, okay. Yes. So 68, where did you move from?
That was when we moved to the north.
To the north, okay, yes.
And that's where I took most of my photographs,
mm-hmm.
which I'm very proud of those photographs. They're now in the collection of Smithsonian Institution mm-hmm. and archives there. People can look at them. And it was such a wonderful place to photograph. People were not self-conscious about being photographed. And I didn't speak their languages, which in a way was easier because I could just sit back and see what I could learn by looking.
Yeah.
And what I always took photographs of anyway was people and people's interaction, and that was what I was doing.
Is it called Yelwa?
Yelwa.
Yelwa. Yeah. I want to read another little bit in the book here. You say, "Now that I'm losing my eyesight and my vision dims, I'm becoming more aware of sounds. Oddly enough, sounds from the past come back and echo in my ears as I remember long ago happenings. And so when I think of Yelwa, sounds run around the photographs that I struggle to see, around the pictures in my mind. I hear the sounds of the river, the town, the workplaces, the music, the voices in the family compounds." Can you see the pictures anymore that you took? I don't know how much vision you have left.
No, they're very out of focus. Yeah. Andrea, thank God, can see them and did to put this book together. Yeah. But I can make them out, but I can't work on them or do anything with them.
There's another amusing story of your family in a marketplace, and a crowd gathers around you, some of them reaching out to touch the children's hair. They're these little, blonde kids. And Evan tells them to bug off, right? And the crowd starts to repeat, bug off, bug off. Did they even know what she was saying?
No, not at all, not at all. But they were Fulani. They were very different tribal areas, tribal groups in that area of Yelma. And the Fulani were quite aloof in certain ways. They were nomadic cattle herders. They came to the market to sell milk. And they were not like other people. And they looked at us as though we were the strangers. We were the weird people in their air, which, of course, to them, we were.
Yeah.
And they were not shy at all. They would pat us and bothered the kids, because the kids were very blonde, and they would stroke the children's hair. And then Evan got cross, and she said, bug off. She was a very feisty little kid, bug off. And they all thought this was very intriguing. Bug off. Bug off. Bug off.
And you wonder how often they maybe said that again, not knowing what that meant. Maybe it was some kind of greeting. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. So now you're a single mother of two. You come back to America to your parents' summer home on Cape Cod. Tell us about that.
Oh, I was in Wellfleet. My parents had a summer place there, which I had spent in my summers in as a kid. And I didn't know where to go in America. And I thought I'd go back. I didn't have a job. My marriage had fallen apart. And Jonathan was on to other work. And so I took the kids to Cape Cod, and I thought I would go and live in Cambridge, where I had lived earlier and liked it a lot. And my parents took care of the kids for a while, and I found a place to live, and I found a job, and moved to Cambridge and began a new life.
Mm. And you mentioned, you sort of touched on this, but tell us about the exhibition, Families, A Celebration of Diversity, Commitment, and Love. That's what the Smithsonian picked up, right?
Oh, you know, that's an interesting story, because I'm just hearing the news about the book issues in school library issues in Florida. That was a book. I interviewed a whole bunch of different families about themselves, with a child of each group being the spokesperson for that family. And there was a gay family. There was a mixed race, there any kind of family you can imagine, practically, we had in this book. And it was very sweet, benign book, and yet I realized in a lot of schools and libraries, it would be banned, which is horrifying.
Yeah, it really is. So Jonathan stayed in Africa and married, had two more children, right? So you have this blended family now, right? Because you remain close. Your kids go to Africa in the summer to visit with their father, and that frees up your time, right, to explore a book project in Guatemala. Tell us about that.
That was wonderful. I had been to Guatemala many years ago and loved the Indian communities there. And I had the summer free, and I didn't have a job at that moment. And I phoned a friend of mine, Lisa Krober, and said, "Want to go to Guatemala and write a book?" She said, "Sure." And for some wild reason, it worked. Yeah. We had introductions to people in an Indian village. We met a family there, said, "We'd like to do a book about you." They said, "Okay." And we did, and it got published. It was a nice little book.
Yeah, and you have photographs of that, some of the photos in the book.
Right. And it has a book of its own.
Yeah, wow. We're talking with writer and photographer Ailette Janess about her book, Sometime a Clear Light, A Photographer's Journey Through Alaska, Nigeria, and Life. We'll talk more after a quick break.
I got a bowling ball here once. There's no bowling alley on Nantucket.
Matty Oates at the Take It or Leave It at the Nantucket Dump.
So somebody brought a bowling ball here because they bowled in Ohio. I like bowling. I got nothing against bowling. But sitting here, a bowling ball, I had to take it. Like, it weighed 90 pounds. I had to carry it out of here. But there's no bowl. It's like the contrast of its existence was weird.
You're listening to WCAI. Local public radio for the Cape, Coast, and Islands. Online at capeandislands.org.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Ailette Janess, author of Sometime a Clear Light, A Photographer's Journey Through Alaska, Nigeria, and Life. All right, let's bring in your collaborators into the conversation. We have editor Chris Wisniewski and designer Andrea Pluhar. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
All right, so tell me, Chris, how did this collaboration work? How did you get involved?
Well, I'm a friend of Ailette's, and I have a business where I'm a personal historian, and I help individuals and families collect their stories, and I turn them into books for them. Mm-hmm. So Ailette knew about my business, Saving Stories, and she asked me to help her with the story that she had been actually working on for, we were just talking about this, about 10 years, yeah. 7 or 10 years. And it started out as a collection of stories about Africa, and then it kind of grew into stories about her life. But she had written it in segments over the course of 7 or 10 years and had different people try to edit it and organize it, and she kept adding to it, and this was happening as her vision was going. So it was harder and harder for Ailette to actually look at the pages and do the editing herself. Mm-hmm. So she asked me to come in and try to help her with this.
So now that you can't read this other, how did the finished product. I mean, did you tell her what you wrote? Did you read it to her?
I read it to her.
You read it to her.
Yeah,
okay.
This was only the second time that I've read a client's life story back to them out loud.
Wow.
Which is a very powerful experience.
Yeah.
Partly because they're a great audience for that story. Sure. They really like the story.
So, Ailette, what were your thoughts as she read this to you?
It blew me away because I had never heard it read out loud.
Yeah.
I wanted certain things changed. I couldn't change them myself, but Chris could.
Yeah.
It was a wonderful collaboration. Yeah. And she often has the words that I don't seem to have. Right. Puts them in.
All right, Andrea, tell us about how you got involved.
Oh, well, I've actually been working with Ailette's Images for, I don't know, a decade and a half, maybe. I've known Ailette all my life. She's known me all my life, I should probably say.
Since before you were born.
Since before I was born,
yeah.
Yes. That was a friend of my mother's. And we actually moved up to Wellfleet about the same time I did. So I don't know exactly when it started, but you started writing your book many, many years ago and asked for help printing photographs.
Right.
And then you did an exhibit. Ailette did an exhibit at the library, local library, and I printed all those photographs for her and worked on a lot of them and began to know them quite well.
So when you're putting this book together, I imagine there's a lot of photographs that Ailette had that you did not put in the book, right? So
yes.
What was that process like deciding where Ailette can't really see them anymore? You had to be her eyes for that.
Well, she remembers many of them, mm-hmm. and had very clear ideas about what story the pictures were to tell, mm-hmm. and how to sequence the images. The African images, there are about 2,000 of those altogether. I worked with Ailette on those. We went through every single one and talked about every single one in order to prepare a finding tool for the Smithsonian. Mm. So that was a year's project, so we would sit down and we went through every single contact sheet there, and I wrote little notes for them. Yeah. So I knew them pretty well when I started this book.
It's interesting because I was looking at some, just kind of looking reviews and things, and somebody had written in the comment section, this book is worth it just for the photos alone. That I mean, the photos could have made the book, right?
The photos are amazing.
Yeah. And then,
all of them.
Yeah.
The Alaskan ones, the Alaskan ones, the African ones, and the Guatemalan ones. Mm-hmm. I love the Guatemalan pictures myself, but I spent a couple of years in Colombia as a child, so they was very evocative to me, the Guatemalan ones.
We're also now working on Instagram with Ailette, with her photos, which is interesting to work on a platform that Ailette can't see,
right.
Right. and explain to her how Instagram works, but it's a great way to get her photos out there.
That's,
so she's on Instagram at Ailette Jeunesse.
Yeah. All right, so this is a self-published book, right? Mm-hmm. So talk about the challenge there.
Well, for me, it was very exciting because I have done probably 11 or so books before that, one on Nigeria, actually, with photographs, and one on Guatemala. But I had never worked directly with a designer at all. I'd never even met the designer, seen the designers of the other books. And then I had worked with an editor, but very small compared to what we did. So to me, it was an amazing growth, this putting this book together.
And I suppose there's pros and cons to that, right? I mean, the pro is like you get to have a say in everything, right? Where sometimes when you're working with a in a big publishing company, they or an editor might say, "Yep, nope, we're not going to include that," right? So it really is a collaboration the three of you were working on. So that's the pro. I guess the con side would be sometimes you get a little more help with you know, promotion and things like that with books when you have a big publishing company.
A lot more help.
That's a big con. That's the problem. That's the problem with self-publishing.
So just getting the word out and it's tricky.
So how did you determine which photos to include? I know that Andrea helped you with that, but did you go, okay, I remember this photo, I want to make sure that's in? I mean, how what was that collaboration like, choosing between these 2,000 photos?
It was how would you describe it?
Well, Aylette had favorite images, and I knew what those favorite images was from working on the exhibit earlier and the earlier book, the earlier versions of the book. And she remembers those from when she could see. So I, you know, we knew those images were in there. And then the rest of it was just a question of how you lay out a page. So that the page itself tells a story, so that it has a consistent mood. It has a nice layout. The eye goes through it nicely, and then you turn the page, and there's some consistency from page to page, and you know, sort of a storytelling idea throughout the galleries. Yeah. I think of them as galleries,
And photos to go with the stories that
are
in the
exactly.
book. So that was a big
because that
part
was something too. I was looking about, like, okay, are there any? There's a picture of you, I think, with Daniel, and I can't remember the young man's name that was the antiquities dealer. But I was like, oh, you do. You kind of were reading the stories, and I'm flipping through trying to see like what pictures go with that exactly.
One of the interesting things that's coming up now is that, but we're doing an ebook. You want to know about that?
Oh, yeah.
And that's a whole different.
I just did it. I just created an EPUB out of it, which, who knew, is like creating a website.
Yeah.
You know, it's all HTML and CSS, which thankfully I know. But that was very different because I found that the images, as I laid them out on the page, is now it's a different item because in the ebook, they're more like a slideshow.
Right.
So I had to sequence them differently in order for them to make sense. Yeah. And I eliminated quite a few because there are a lot of times when I put images on a page in order to create the story. I mean, they're images that make absolutely no sense. They don't really make any sense on their own.
Right.
You know, there's like a rock outcropping in one of the Alaska pages. It's there just for composition, really, and for a sense of space, depth, you know, focus, whatever.
All right, so, Chris, did you have a favorite story? You were very, you know, intimate with this book. You know, you've read it and edited it, and, you know, was there something in there that jumped out to you? I really like the little chicken story, but...
one aspect of this book that I found really interesting is this whole concept of trying to get insight into her past while she's losing her physical sight. So to me, I find the most interesting things are these little vignettes that we've included in almost every section, where most of the book, the majority of the book, takes place in the past. But then there are these little vignettes of her thinking through what had happened.
Like the last one I just read about her losing her sight and the sounds.
And so it's that contrast, and it's such an interesting concept to me, this losing your physical sight while you're trying to gain your insight.
Right.
And so to me, it's more of those that really kind of pull me in.
It's a good point.
And give a real insight into why this book is important.
Aylette, as you said, you started losing your sight about 30 or 40 years ago. And so it's been a gradual thing, right? But have you, you talk about the sounds and where you know other senses seem to kind of pick up as you lose your eyesight. Is that something that occurred to you recently, or did you notice it as it was happening?
I think I paid more and more attention to it as time went on, listening to other things. But I'm also struck now that there's so many aids to helping with vision. I have a machine that I can put anything in print written down on, and it'll read it aloud to me.
Oh, wow.
I mean, they're just amazing stuff like that.
Yeah. All right, Andrea, what about you? What's your favorite part of the book? For you, I'm imagining it's got to be some of the photos, right?
Yes. I mean, the stories are amazing. Yeah. There's actually, you know, I was just thinking that there's some email exchanges between Jonathan and Ailette that happen later on in the book that I find very moving. I knew Jonathan, and my father also worked for the UN, so there's some connection there, and some connection about living in foreign, you know, working as Jonathan did. Anyway, but the images really, you know, some of the African images, the Guatemalan images, as I said before. I think that the Guatemalan images are actually artistically better than any of the other ones. And that makes sense because Ailette's older and more experienced.
Right.
And you can actually see that her eye has developed over time. Mm-hmm. And there's something about the composition and what she's looking at and how she's looking at what she's seeing in two dimensions that is really more sophisticated than earlier.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ailette, what did the kids think about the book?
My kids?
Your kids, yeah.
My daughter is a lawyer, and she wants to be very sure that there are no photographs of her as a little kid with not enough clothes on. That's the thing that comes around here. But I think they're pleased with the work.
Yeah.
It's their lives, and they like it, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, feel very close to them. We're not geographically close. She's in L.A., my daughter, and my son's in Amherst, Massachusetts, Keurig. But I feel very close to them and attuned with this whole thing.
I wonder, because I was thinking, you know, in Alaska, obviously they were very little, so they probably don't have any memory of Alaska, do they? Or do they remember some?
Not really.
Yeah. But they have memories of Africa.
Oh, yeah.
And because they spent also visited all the time with your husband after. Yeah. Yeah. Any other final thoughts? Yeah,
well,
go ahead, Chris.
Ailette is about to start working on an audiobook of this, because it's a very important population for her to reach out to, vision impaired people. So that's about to start happening next month, I think.
I have a wonderful reader, has a great voice, a very experienced person, and a friend who's going to do the taping.
Yeah.
And probably not till summer, but we'll have an audiobook up. We'll have it up with the others.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's important for blind issues.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The book is Sometime, A Clear Light, A Photographer's Journey Through Alaska, Nigeria, and Life. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Thank you so much for being with us and sharing your book.
Thank you for
having us. Thank you, Mindy. Thank you.
Coming up after a break, Notes from a Pandemic.